stress, feeling down, or something else. Given the ongoing headaches, and especially the severe headache I had the other day, she is concerned about swelling or inflammation around the brain lesions. Can you bring this up with Dr. A and see what he thinks? Many thanks. I am furious. My own daughter is betraying me. Kasia is a very smart physician, and I know that she's upset and worried about me. But she is being hysterical and irrational, and she's really overstepping her bounds, as if there's something wrong with me. I have my own very good mind, and I have much more life experience than she does. Everyone in the family respects my intuition and judgment, not only about my own well-being, but about the health of all of us. Kasia may be an experienced doctor, but she calls me when she doesn't feel well. She calls me when her kids are sick, and not just to share her worries and seek comfort. She always wants my advice. Mom, do you think it's serious? Should I call the pediatrician? What if the fever gets worse? What if... I always tell her what I would do, and more often than not, she follows my advice. I am still her wise, trusted mother, after all, so why is she treating me like this? I email Kasia back. I will not write it. Maybe I will call the doctor, but please do not tell me what to do. Mama is in charge of her own fate and will do what she thinks is appropriate. I know you are worried. It is moving, but please leave my decisions to myself. I am fine. Moments later, Kasia responds with an email. Mama, okay. I respect your decisions and will do as you wish. I don't call the doctor. A little while later, Kasia calls me and offers again to contact them herself. For whatever reason, I don't object anymore. An hour later, I get a phone call from Dr. Atkins's nurse, who says she's received Kasia's email and wants me to come immediately to the hospital. She's scheduled an emergency MRI for an hour from now. Let's go and get the MRI, Mirek says. Even though he isn't pushing me, something about the way he speaks makes me suspicious. Why is Kasia plotting against me? Mirek is on her side too. They're all against me. I'm still annoyed, but I agree to go. I pick up my car keys and head outside. But you've been having some trouble with directions. Why don't you just relax and let me drive? Mirek suggests. I always drive, I retort, and climb into the driver's seat. He reluctantly gives in. No sooner do we get onto the highway, however, when he starts shouting, "Watch out! Look out!" What is he going on about? "You're not inside the lane," he cries. "Stay in the centre. No, no, you're crossing over the line again. Pull back, pull back." "I'm fine," I insist. "It just looks different from where you're sitting. Why are you so critical of me all the time? Can't you just be quiet?" But cars behind us start honking, and I realize I'm about to hit the truck to my left. I swerve sharply at the last minute. Mirek has his head in his hands. "Oh, stop it," I say. "Nothing happened. It's not a big deal. Get over it." With no further drama, we check in at the Georgetown MRI Center. A nurse inserts the needle into a vein in my arm so that contrast liquid can be injected. I lie on a narrow table, and a technician slides me into a powerful magnet that looks like a tight tube. With my head secured in a plastic crate and my body wrapped in white blankets, I look like a mummy. I remain motionless while the magnetic field is switched on and off to the accompaniment of loud tapping noises from vibrating coils that are invisible to me. Unable to see anything in this tunnel, I'm alone with the mangled thoughts in my confused brain. The knock, 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 knock sound of the MRI machine, repeated over and over in varying rhythms and pitches, is strangely relaxing. I like the solitude. I feel cozy and safe, happily cocooned in this tight space. It shields me from the non-stop stimuli of the outside world. After an hour, the MRI wraps up. I dress and find Mirek waiting in the hallway. "Done," I say. "Let's go home." Before we reach the parking garage, Mirek's cell phone rings. "What? Why?" he says. "Oh, Okay, we'll be there right away. He turns to me and says, we have to go immediately to the emergency room. Why? What's happening? The nurse said your brain is very swollen, Mirek says. As we walk over, I realize my headache has returned, insistent and intense. In the ER, they take me quickly to a back room and check my blood pressure. It is very high. They lead me to a cubicle where I lie down in bed behind a curtain amid the awful noises of trauma and emergency. People outside my cubicle run and shout and cry and scream. Here I am again, just 5 months after they discovered the bleeding tumor in my brain. But I'm not worried in the least. In fact, I don't fully understand why we're here. Merrick's eyes are sad, his face troubled. But I can't fathom why he's upset. I try to cheer him up, try to joke, but his expression doesn't change. He just holds my hand and looks at me. After a while, my oncologist, Dr. Atkins, enters my cubicle with two of his nurses. They look at me with such sorrow that I think some kind of a mistake has been made. They can't be worrying about me. Why should they? The MRI shows new tumors in your brain, Dr. Atkins says. The immunotherapy didn't work. I'm really sorry. I look from face to face. Mirek is somber. Dr. Atkins seems deeply disappointed, as if he's failed me. My poor doctor. He doesn't understand. I'm fine. There's also swelling and serious inflammation of brain tissue. Dr. Atkins continues. I'm prescribing high doses of steroids right away to reduce the swelling, and I'm admitting you to the hospital. Oh, Dr. Atkins, I feel so sorry for him. Let me reassure him. No, no, please wait, I say. I don't want steroids. From what I've read, steroids will reduce my immune response and interfere with my treatment. And I know the immunotherapy worked. I know it. I'm sorry about this inflammation in my brain, but you know it can happen. There are often setbacks with immunotherapy before there's improvement. Don't worry, please. I will be fine. I look at Dr. Atkins, then at Mirek. His eyes are filled with tears. The two nurses also look as if they're about to cry. All of this fuss for no reason. Let me explain to them what's happening. Maybe that will calm them down. Tumors often get larger at first when this treatment begins, I say. I remember that, I swear I do, from several scientific publications I read just weeks ago. The tumors you see on the MRI may look larger than they really are because my T cells are fighting the melanoma cells and killing them. What you're seeing is evidence of this dramatic war in my brain. We have to give my body time to clean up this ugly battlefield. Just have to wait, trust me. But Dr. Atkins shakes his head. They all look through me, past me, their eyes glistening, their faces solemn. They talk among themselves, not really listening to me. They lean over my bed, examine my face, and worry. I feel so sorry for them. I wish they could understand that I'm right. Mirek tells me Kasia is on her way from New Haven, and she arrives a few hours later, joining us in the hospital room to which I've been moved. I am stunned to see her. Kasia, oh, baby, you shouldn't have done this. I'm really okay, I assure her. She begins to cry. She has cancelled her Italian vacation with Jake and the boys, something they'd planned for a year to rush here. I'm happy she's with us, but flabbergasted at her decision and her outpouring of emotion. This is a lot of excitement for no reason, I tell her. I am fine. I am fine. By now it's almost night, and Kasia climbs onto the bed with me, just as she did in January, as tired and upset now as she was then. It feels good to have her so close, but I still don't understand the urgency. I don't know how to persuade her and Mirek and Dr. Atkins that there's really no reason to fret so much. A few hours later, Mirek and Kasia go home, telling me they'll return in the morning. Of course, I say cheerily. I'll be fine. I don't really need anything. Don't worry and don't hurry. Have a nice bike ride in the morning. I don't have a toothbrush with me or even a change of clothes, but I'm feeling upbeat and well. The headache is gone. Hours later, I send them a selfie that shows me smiling in my hospital garb in bed. But I don't have a restful night. Nights in hospital are never good. So much commotion and noise, bright lights and beeping machines. I'm awakened at dawn by a nurse checking my vitals and changing the bags on the IV pole. I'm angry to be roused from sleep and hungry, so, so hungry. When is breakfast? I ask. Soon, she replies. But I'm hungry, I respond. I'm hungry. I want to eat. It's my only thought. At 7 o'clock, my breakfast still has not arrived. Nor is it there at 8 or 9. I'm fuming. When the nurse reappears, I pounce. How is it possible that breakfast hasn't been served yet? I scold. What a terrible hospital this is. My insurance is paying hundreds of dollars a day for me to be here. Appalling! Breakfast itself will probably cost $100, and it's late. I repeat my complaint to everyone who comes into my room. 10 o'clock arrives, and still no breakfast, and no Kasia or Mirek either. When they finally telephone, I let them know I'm furious that they're not here yet with some food. After we hang up, I walk into the nurse's station, dragging my IV pole, and demand my meal. The nurse explains that because I'm a new patient, it takes longer than usual to order my breakfast. I storm off, stop a doctor in the hallway, and insist he hear my tirade. No breakfast! How pitiful! How irresponsible! My insurance is paying for it! No one can escape me. Not the nurses, not other patients. They all need to hear my breakfast story, and I make sure they do. Finally, at 10:30 a.m., the hospital staff brings my breakfast. Just as Mirek and Kasia arrive, carrying oatmeal with fruit and nuts, my favorite morning meal. First, I devour the hospital food, then the treats from my family. But I remain unhappy. I repeat to Kasia and Mirek the story of the tardy breakfast, and retell it, and tell it again. Every nurse and doctor who comes into the room is greeted with the story of this injustice. They try to ask me about my headache and other medical issues, but I want to tell them that my food was late, and I'm still hungry. Can't they bring me more? I see that my daughter is cross. She tells me to stop. Mom, don't you understand that you are seriously ill? She says, her eyes welling up. You have new tumors in your brain. Why are you stuck on unimportant things like breakfast and food when your life is in danger? I can't believe what I'm hearing. Breakfast? Unimportant, I retort. Of course it's important. It's important for me. Kasia leaves the room. I can hear her just outside the door, talking to a doctor who has come to examine me. When she re-enters, she's crying. Her emotional reaction puzzles me. Why do you want to talk about tumors and sad things like that? I tell her. What's the point? What can I do about it? You're overreacting. Mom, you're very sick, she responds. Don't you get it? You're panicking. Calm down. Then I add, the whole world is against me. I don't recognize you. You're not the mother I've known all my life. She continues sobbing. I stare into the distance silently. Nobody loves me anymore. I simply can't believe they don't agree with me about this breakfast debacle. Breakfast at 10:30, for what we're paying. At the hospital, I continue to polish off everything on my meal trays while asking my family to bring more food from home. I find the hospital crackers especially alluring. I gobble them up and look for more. Everything is delicious. Mid-afternoon the next day, Sunday, June the 21st, they release me from the hospital. I'm going to continue on high doses of oral steroids, and I have an appointment with Dr. Atkins in a few days to hear details about my condition and discuss options. Until then, we're just waiting. Nobody in the family mentions the possibility of further treatment. Death hovers among us like a ghost. When we get home, I'm still very hungry, and I insist on making dinner. But I'm baffled as I try to prepare the meal. I can't find the pots and pans or anything I need. When Mirek offers to take over, I tell him to leave me alone. Kasia also tries to help me, but I criticize her efforts so much that she, too, retreats. We three eat dinner in near silence. Over the next few days, I find it harder and harder to prepare our meals. I have no idea how to adjust the measurements and recipes I use for just Mirek and me in order to make enough for Kasia, too. I also forget the proportions of ingredients in even the simplest recipes. How much water in relation to pasta? How much salt to add for that much water? And I completely lose the ability to plan. I can't figure out which dishes need to be cooked first in order to time the meal appropriately, or even which ingredients to add to which recipe and when. I can't even bake bread anymore, a ritual that I've been performing every week for years using a starter yeast from Poland. No matter how much I try, I can't remember how to do it. Yet, as frustrated as I am in the moment, I do not reflect on what it all might mean. It's as if I don't remember that just weeks before I was good at these things. I make no connection between the serious problems in my brain and the fact that I can't cook my favorite dishes. Even as I struggle to function in the kitchen, my obsession with food continues. I will gain 10 pounds between the middle of June and the beginning of July, and it won't bother me at all. When I emerged from brain surgery in January, I was very thin. I weighed 118 pounds, the thinnest I'd been in adulthood. But soon I'll soar to 138 pounds, more than I would normally think of carrying on my 5-foot-6-inch frame. And I don't care. Steroids often cause people to gain weight, but that's only part of the problem. I simply cannot stop myself from eating. It's not about being hungry. It's just that these treats look so good that I'm going to eat them. Why not? Worried about the health consequences of so much sugar, Kasia gently suggests that I might want to try taming my ravenous appetite. An endocrinologist, she's particularly concerned because I'm on steroids. Steroids combined with too much sugar can cause hyperglycemia. "Mom, please," Kasia says. "You don't want to be eating all of the ice cream, do you?" "Leave me alone," I retort. "You can't tell me what to eat. It's my business, not yours." None of us see it at the time, but my obsession with eating is a classic sign of frontal lobe problems, which in my case are compounded by steroids that by themselves increase appetite. People with frontotemporal dementia often gain significant amounts of weight very quickly, since they have no inhibitor on their drive to eat. When the frontal cortex is operating as it should, people have the ability to weigh the pros and cons of fulfilling their desires. But when that function is silenced or gone, they just do what they want with zero concern about the consequences. "I love sweets, so I'm going to eat them. Period." On Wednesday, June the 24th, Kasia, Mirek and I return to Dr. Atkins' office to learn what's next for me. I'm curious to hear what he has to say. The steroids are giving me so much energy and I feel so much better that I know I'm on the mend, new tumours or not. I smile at the receptionist as we check in. But Kasia and Mirek aren't in good moods. They sit solemnly in the waiting room until Dr. Atkins' assistant comes to get us. "Hello," I say to her brightly. "Very nice to see you again." She gives me a sad, fleeting smile as she leads us to the examination room. When Dr. Atkins enters, his face is grave. He asks us to take a seat. Three of his nurses, Kelly, Bridget and Dorothy, stand near him, looking heartbroken. "Good afternoon," I say cheerfully, trying to lighten the mood. "How bad can this news be?" "As you know," Dr. Atkins says, "there are new tumours in your brain. We'll simply have to deal with this," I interject. "I've had new tumours before. They'll eventually shrivel and go away, believe me. Bridget, the nurse closest to the door, is failing in her efforts not to cry. She turns her face from us and wipes tears from her cheeks. "Really, it's fine," I assure them. "I'm telling you." "There seem to be at least 18 tumours in your brain," Dr. Atkins says. Kasia gasps. "As you know, you had 3 brain tumours when you entered the trial," Dr. Atkins says. "About 15 new tumours have emerged throughout your brain since the last MRI.
18, Kasia says, her voice breaking.
Marek tenses beside me but says nothing. "Oh, I don't think that's the case," I say. "What you're seeing is something else. Inflammation, perhaps, or some..." Dr. Atkins interrupts and offers to show us my scans in his office next door. Kasia goes out with him, but I don't follow them, and Mirek stays with me. When they return, Kasia's eyes are glistening. The scans show a scattering of small but distinct black spots in my brain. Dr. Atkins tells us, over 18 little shapes the size of raisins. "The largest tumours are in my frontal and parietal lobes," he says, "but they also lurk in the temporal and occipital lobes and in the basal ganglia, a group of brain structures in the base of the brain that help coordinate movement." Later, Kasia will tell me that on the scans, my brain looked like a lump of raisin bread dough. "The largest tumour," Dr. Atkins says, "is in my frontal lobe. It's the size of an almond." "No wonder you've been acting so unlike yourself," Kasia says quietly.
"Really, Kasia, I've been acting that different," I say.
Dr. Atkins nods to Kasia and continues. "And the scans show a number of fuzzy, whitish areas, which means that a large part of your brain is very swollen."
"Mum, I love you," Kasia says in Polish.
"But these steroids will stop the swelling. I'm already feeling better," I say, my smile broadening. I look to Mirek, who is staring at me. I look at the nurses, all of whom are tearing up again. Why are they all so pessimistic? They're overreacting. This doom and gloom is so unnecessary.
"I'm sorry that immunotherapy didn't work," Dr. Atkins says once more. "I was so hopeful that it would."
No one else speaks. A heaviness pervades the room. But I will not give up.
"Well, okay, what's next?" I ask. "What do we do?"
"We'll do radiation therapy of the tumours," he says. "Our radiation oncologist, Dr. Sean Collins, will contact you shortly." "But we all know radiation is no cure."
"And then?" I ask. "What if that doesn't work?"
Dr. Atkins hesitates. "Please, just tell me," I say. "What comes next for me?" I feel detached from my question, like a scientist asking about a specimen in a jar, as if what we're discussing has absolutely nothing to do with my own mortality. "As the swelling increases and places more pressure on your brain, you will likely fall into a coma," Dr. Atkins says.
"A coma?"
"A coma doesn't scare me. It sounds comforting, like sleep."
"And then?" I ask.
"And then you will eventually die," he says quietly.
"Okay," I say. "In the meantime, what should I do? How should I prepare?"
I ask this as matter-of-factly as if I'm seeking advice on weatherproofing the patio. He seems unsure how to respond. Finally, he says, "It's time to get ready for the worst. You should get your affairs in order." Everyone else in the room is choking back tears. I don't feel like crying at all.
"Okay," I nod. "I like a plan of action. I will get my affairs in order."
Then I immediately realised that I don't need to, actually. I straightened out my affairs months ago, when I got the brain cancer diagnosis. The fact that I'm fully prepared gives me a renewed sense of calm and satisfaction. Everyone else looks devastated.
"They're all so upset, but I'm fine. They'll see, I'm fine."
We don't speak another word about death. On the car ride home, Kasia, Mirek and I don't talk much at all.
I sit in the passenger seat, going over in my mind what I've read in the scientific literature about immunotherapy. I'm convinced that this swelling in my brain, these new tumours, are a temporary stage in what will end up being a successful treatment. I recall what the research describes about some cases. The tumours swell, then they shrink and disappear. My ability to remember what I've read about my treatment isn't failing at all, and it's keeping me optimistic. From my long experience studying schizophrenia, I know that brain problems lead to poor judgment and an inability to recognize one's own mental deficits. But at this point, all my years of professional expertise aren't helping me see things as they really are. I'm losing my mind and my life. Several days later, on Sunday, June the 28th, Kasia and I stand in the local Home Depot. Blue, orange, pink, red, white. Impatiens of every colour are arrayed before us under the awning in the garden section. "Mom, we've been here 15 minutes," Kasia says. "Just pick some." I cannot make up my mind. How many do we need? What colours do I want? I like coral, but none of the choices are close to that hue as far as I can tell. Is this coral? I'm not sure. Maybe. But these plants don't look fresh, kind of wilted. Okay, then maybe not coral after all. Maybe red. Kasia sighs in frustration. I can't decide. I give up. After half an hour of closely inspecting flowers, I settle on something purplish. Or reddish, I'm not sure. We get in my car and Kasia drives us to an Asian restaurant in a nearby strip mall for a special treat. Sushi takeout for Marek's birthday. 45 minutes after we left Home Depot, I'm sitting alone at the counter in the restaurant. All around me, people rush about speaking loudly in languages I don't understand. It's lunch hour, a busy time for this casual place. It's filled with people from all over the world, particularly Korea, the country of origin of the most recent wave of immigrants to these northern Virginia suburbs. For some reason, right now I find the commotion entertaining. It's a pleasant distraction, because I'm stuck. I'm trying to think about something, but I'm really struggling. It's hot outside, and hot and stuffy inside the restaurant. The air is filled with exotic aromas, kimchi and steaming plates of noodle soups, marinated meats such as bulgogi, grilled right on the tables around me, garlic, ginger and soy sauces. Such a far cry from our bland Polish cuisine of pierogies and cabbage and meat stewed for hours with onions and wild mushrooms until they resemble a brownish, mushy pulp. Our family mostly did away with those foods years ago. In honour of our Polish tradition, we eat them during the holidays, when we savour them for the nostalgia they bring. Mirek chose sushi for his birthday dinner. It's his favourite. I'd almost forgotten that tomorrow, June the 29th, is his special day. When I called my 87-year-old mother in Poland this morning for our weekly talk, she'd asked, "Is Mirek's birthday tomorrow?" I couldn't remember. I knew this time of year was important in our family because we celebrate two birthdays. Mirek's and Richard's, my brother-in-law. But whose birthday was coming up? I didn't know. "I think so," I'd answered vaguely. To be sure, I had to check with Kasia. "Is tomorrow Richard's birthday or Mirek's? I can't remember." "Tomorrow is Mirek's birthday," she'd said. "Richard's was a few days ago." I should have been surprised that I couldn't remember the birthday of the man to whom I've been married for almost 30 years, a man I love with all my heart. For years, his birthday has also been the code I've used to unlock my cell phone. But I'm not easily surprised nowadays. There are lots of things I can't remember. Numbers, in particular, escape me, and dates are difficult too. Since I'm going in for radiation tomorrow, Kasia and I decided to celebrate Mirek's birthday a day early. And now, as I sit here in the restaurant, I keep staring straight ahead. The waitresses are curious as to what I'm doing, I can tell. With kind smiles, they ask if I need anything more, if they can help. I thank them, but shake my head. The sushi chef across the counter from me, a tall, handsome man, works on a sushi roll, cutting and chopping colourful ingredients, rolling sticky rice wrapped in seaweed with his bare hands, squeezing fancy sauces on top. As he dips his fingers in this and that container, he glances at me with a shy smile. It's been 20 minutes since they delivered our takeout order to me, a big brown bag with a tray of creamy sushi rolls filled with eel, salmon, and whitefish decorated with avocado, wasabi, seaweed, sesame seeds, and other spices. I'm still trapped here at the counter, staring at the bill and trying to figure out the tip. I've made no progress whatsoever. I see lots of numbers scrawled on a small sheet of paper, but they mean nothing to me. I read the numbers, but don't understand what to do with them. I do remember that a tip should be 20%. That concept springs to mind. But I don't understand the notion of percentages. I remember only a bare fact, 20%. Without more context, it is meaningless. What does 20% signify? How does one calculate it? I scrutinize the bill. What was the cost of our sushi? I think that's it, that number there, 70. But if that's how much the food cost, how much is the tip? I turn these questions over in my mind, desperate to find an answer that doesn't come. I change my strategy and start playing with random numbers in my head, then try them on my tongue. $30, I whisper, or $20. No, that doesn't sound right. I throw looks in the direction of the restaurant's front door, through which Kasia disappeared nearly half an hour ago. She went to get the car, I remember, so we wouldn't have to carry the tray too far. Why doesn't she come back? I feel helpless. I open my wallet and find a $10 bill. Okay, maybe $10. I resign myself to the amount that's available, a random bill that I place on the counter. I quickly leave so I won't be stopped and questioned if it's wrong. I feel like a crook. Kasia has been sitting in the car near the entrance to the restaurant all this time. What happened, Mum? What were you doing in there for so long? She asks. I don't know how to reply. Oh, nothing, I say, trying to sound nonchalant. Do you think $10 is okay for the tip? You left a tip on a takeout order. She sounds surprised. Why not? But I had trouble calculating the right amount. She gives me a bewildered look. How much was the sushi? She asks. I hesitate. $70, I say. I feel relieved that I can recall. You couldn't calculate 20% of $70? No. Suddenly I feel inadequate. As we drive home, she starts quizzing me. What's 120 divided by 3? I ponder it. I don't know, I say. What about 12 divided by 3? I have no idea. Can you add 5 and 10? She tries. 15, I shout, overjoyed. 18 minus 5? I don't know. 12, maybe? We experiment with simple arithmetic problems all the way home. We discover that I can add as long as the numbers are simple, but any kind of subtracting, multiplying, or dividing is impossible, no matter how basic the question. These calculations are simply over my head. When we walk into the house, Kasia and I don't talk about it anymore, and we don't mention it to Mirek as we celebrate his birthday with our sushi meal. Kasia doesn't tell me until much later, but it deeply pained her to see me so deteriorated, so altered, from the strong-minded and accomplished person I used to be, her sharp-witted mother, the one who taught her math and logic, as well as the importance of honesty and how to enjoy her life. She doesn't want our roles to change. She doesn't want to be a physician examining my symptoms and observing my strange new behaviours in an attempt to understand what's wrong. She wants her loving, fun, competent mama, not this confused, angry, self-absorbed imposter. As Dr. Iser will explain to me much later, my compromised math ability, which is called dyscalculia or acalculia, is most likely related to the lesion and inflammation in my parietal lobe, the area located just behind the frontal lobe on top of the brain. Together, the frontal and parietal lobes make up about two-thirds of our species' highly evolved neocortex, which comprises the four lobes of the brain. Lesions or defects in the frontal and parietal lobes have been linked with dyscalculia in patients with early stages of dementia. Scientists have been able to trace different aspects of numerical processing, such as multiplication and subtraction, to different subregions of the parietal lobe. Thus, people with lesions in a particular area of the parietal lobe may show deficits in the ability to perform one type of calculation, but not others. In my case, I seem to be able to add simple numbers, but I cannot handle division, subtraction, or multiplication. It may well be that the swelling in my brain is affecting the function of specific subregions of the parietal lobe, while leaving others relatively unscathed. Lesions in my parietal lobe, which Dr. Atkins pointed out to us during our last visit, may be giving rise to other problems I'm experiencing. The parietal lobe has a role in processing topographic memory, the ability to recall the shape and structure of a previously experienced place, or to hold in one's mind the map of a place. It's also involved in motor planning, the ability to plot and execute skilled tasks that aren't habitual, and it's involved in the ability to have insight into one's illness, which I clearly lack. For me, all of these functions are now impaired. Incredibly, though, my writing ability is not deteriorating at all. If anything, it's getting stronger despite my short-term memory problems. Not only are my language skills still intact, they are also surprisingly robust. Perhaps fueled by steroids, my creativity is on fire. I awaken at 4 or 5 o'clock each morning and prop myself up in bed, my laptop on my knees. My mind is swirling with ideas on how to describe what I feel. My emotions and memories are so intense and sometimes so bizarre that I have to turn them into words, both to unload the burden and to share these vivid recollections with others before they fade. It's as if I'm compensating for the shortfalls of real life by transferring them onto virtual paper, a computer screen. I write about my childhood in Poland, about my beloved grandma taking us into the primitive, remote villages of the Beskid Mountains on our summer vacations. With an overpowering delight, I retrieve long-forgotten memories of the smell of sweet hay and cow manure. I gather mushrooms in the woods, cross icy streams and pick wild blackberries with my grandma and my little sister. These memories from more than 50 years ago are so vivid and pleasurable that I don't want them to disappear. I type pages and pages, recalling when my sister and I were little girls living in a world far away. I remember it as clearly as if it happened yesterday. When Maria comes to visit in July, I share these memories with her. She's amazed and delighted at the incredible details I can recall from our earliest years. But I also detect that reminiscing about our childhood makes her sad, although I don't know why. Only later will I realize that she, like everyone in my family, is traumatized by the prospect that soon I will cease to exist, and memories of me will be all that will remain. Throughout July, family members take turns visiting me. My sister and her husband, then Kasia, then my son and Cheyenne, then Kasia again. They keep me company, and I like it. It's flattering that they pay so much attention to me, but they're all anxious and somber. I sense that something is horribly wrong, and that's why they're rotating through here so often. But I can't figure out what they're worried about. Since I began taking high doses of steroids, I don't have headaches anymore, which is a great relief. I'm upbeat, unmoved by the latest news of the multiple new metastases in my brain. Tumours, more tumours. Oh well, what should I make for lunch today? I'm feeling almost happy, and I would feel even better were it not for the uneasy sense that my family knows something I don't. Some kind of a tragic secret that I don't fully comprehend.
8. Chanterelles. A week after being released from Georgetown University Hospital, I return as an outpatient to undergo radiation treatment to most of the 15 or so new tumours in my brain, including the ones that weren't radiated before I started the clinical trial. For the time being, only the two smallest, tumours too tiny to target, will be left untreated. This is the first time I will undergo the CyberKnife procedure. As opposed to the stereotactic radiosurgery that I received in March after neurosurgery at the Brigham, the CyberKnife robotic radiosurgery system is almost fully automated. Now, as I did in March, I lie strapped to a gurney with a plastic mask tightly covering my face to hold my head still. A mask that was, in both cases, custom-made for me from plastic mesh. With the CyberKnife, sophisticated software is aided by ongoing CT scanning that tracks the tumour's positions and reacts to even the tiniest movements of my head. The CyberKnife shoots beams of high-dose radiation into the tumours from multiple directions using a high-energy X-ray machine mounted on a robotic arm. Painless and non-invasive, there's no cutting involved despite its name. But extreme accuracy is essential so that healthy tissue is spared while the tumours are destroyed. Relying on precise calculations and a great deal of planning, any targeted radiation procedure, either CyberKnife or SRS, involves an impressive team. Physicists, like my sister, Maria Cherminska, an oncology physicist in Boston. Radiation oncologists, like Dr. Collins at Georgetown and Dr. Iser at the Brigham, and dosimetrists, who calculate the doses of radiation and determine the optimal beam trajectories to minimize damage to the healthy brain tissue. As the CyberKnife zaps my tumors, I lie as still as possible and gaze at the ceiling in the darkened room. My mind wanders into meadows and woods. I visualize a brightly shining sun and follow imaginary kites that float in a blue sky. In my head, I rhyme verses in Polish about the wounds in my brain becoming filled with green grass and blooming violets, while the sadness of these many days of stress slips slowly out into the woods. Brain radiation.
O nasze mamy głowo dziurawa. Widziurej wyrasta zielona trawa. Przez dziury smutek spływa do lasu. Na smutki szkoda jest głowie czasu. Zielone trawie fioki, dmuchawca. I podziesone stara latawca. W dziurawej głowie figle, jochotki. Lekkaj jest głowie zionicz piotki.
Holes like winter potholes dot my broken head. They quickly fill with mud and make a flower bed. Green grass covers the holes. Flowers begin to bloom. Dandelions and violets take over the holy gloom. Sorrow like water seeps through my ailing brain. It soothes the worried soul, eases the gnawing pain. There is no point to worry having a grassy head. It's funny. It giggles and chuckles, it laughs and dreams. It's not dead. Finally, I am sent home, tired and stiff, but relieved that one more mission in my battle to live has been accomplished. For a little while, there is nothing to do but wait and hope. I take it easy the next day, surrounded by my husband and children. Vitek and Cheyenne are here now too. I feel almost joyous, as if we're back to a normal life. The following morning, less than 2 days after the CyberKnife procedure, I wake up early, feeling healthy and strong, and as if nothing extraordinary has happened in the previous weeks. It's a beautiful summer day, and I propose we go for a morning of light exercise in the woods of our favourite training ground, Prince William Forest Park. A gorgeous expanse with miles of hiking and running trails, the park was developed by the Works Progress Administration during the Great Depression. This month, Vitek, Cheyenne and Kasia are preparing for triathlons. I was forced to put aside my own triathlon training after getting sick in January, although throughout this whole ordeal, I've never stopped working out. Almost every day, no matter how I felt, I ran, walked, swam or cycled. Today, as always, I'm eager for some physical activity. Even at the not-so-fast pace I now take, walking in the woods relaxes me. With my loved ones around me, it will be a great escape from the doctors and hospital rooms. I crave this trip. I need to feel as normal as possible. The asphalt road through Prince William Forest Park is a loop of about 7.5 miles of hilly terrain. Whenever I'm training for a triathlon, I cycle it 4 or 5 times and then run it once. Since I've just been released from the hospital after being treated for profound brain swelling, and since I'm 2 days post-radiation, I decide to take it easy. I will walk just 1 7-plus-mile loop. "Are you sure?" Marek asks, concerned. For our entire marriage, we've always checked on each other. But since I've gotten sick, Marek has been obsessed with my safety. "I'm fine, absolutely fine," I assure him. Marek loads his bike and Kasia's into our Toyota RAV4 and we head out, Vitek and Cheyenne following in their car. It is already hot when we pull into the small parking lot we always use. We agree to meet back at the car when our workouts are finished and reward ourselves with a picnic lunch in the park. They all volunteer to check on me as we pass one another along the road. Vitek, Cheyenne and Kasia take off on their bikes. Marek kisses me on the cheek, hugs me and pedals off on his own. I hit the asphalt road and begin to walk, my arms swinging purposefully, my stride long and determined. The smell of the woods, the chirping birds, the waving branches of the tall trees make me feel free and happy. I breathe in deeply and my lungs fill with fragrant air. After about an hour, I pass a wide field that is yellow with chanterelle mushrooms. Chanterelles, meaty golden mushrooms with exotic ribbed underbellies and a strong peppery smell and taste, are a family favourite. They evoke memories of Poland, where they were abundant and we picked them in the woods around our summer home or on the outskirts of Warsaw. We love to cook them in various sauces or sauté them in olive oil and serve with scrambled eggs. I'm delighted to see so many chanterelles and eager to gather as many as I can. But I have no bag to put them in, so I keep power walking. Luckily, Mirek soon rides up on his bike. "There's a field full of chanterelles just a little ways back," I tell him. "Can you go to the car and get a bag and pick some? We'll have them for breakfast tomorrow with scrambled eggs." Mirek takes off and I continue on my walk. After another 90 minutes of vigorous walking, I finish the 7.5 miles and reach the parking lot. Although I was filled with energy when I began 2.5 hours ago, I'm now completely exhausted, so physically and emotionally spent that I feel like I've run a marathon. With an almost primal urgency, I feel a desperate need to rest and eat immediately. But to my surprise, Marek isn't back yet. I will call him. But I can't remember his number, and for some weird reason I can't recall how to find his number on my cell. I fumble with the phone, and then I forget what I'm doing. What's this about? Oh yes, I'm trying to call Marek. But where's his number? How do I call him? I fiddle with the phone, trying to figure it out.
and over, I have to keep reminding myself what I'm trying to accomplish. Finally, I locate his number in my contacts list and call him. "There are so many chanterelles," he says excitedly. "I've collected a huge bagful." "We need to eat lunch right now," I say angrily. "Great," he says. "I'll be waiting here for you." "No, no, you come here." "I can't bring them on the bike. They'll get squashed," he answers. "I'll wait for you on the side of the road." Only after we hang up do I realize I have absolutely no idea how to find him. I know this park like my own backyard. I've cycled and run and walked it scores of times over the years. Just an hour or so earlier, I'd told Mirek where to find the chanterelles. But now my mind is frozen. I can't picture his location at all. Driving the car to him seems like an insurmountable challenge, a feat completely beyond my ability. I stand with cell phone in hand, fuming. How the hell am I going to find him? I decide to call him back. But once again, I can't figure out how to find his number. I can't seem to think straight. How do I call him? I concentrate very hard and try again. And again. After enormous effort, I find his number, but by now I'm very frustrated and growing angrier. "Come here now, Mirek," I snap. "I don't know where you are." "Just drive down the road," he responds. "You can't miss me." "Which way?" I plead. "It's a one-way road, darling," he says. That confuses me even more. What does one way mean? It makes no sense. Even though I've driven on this road dozens and dozens of times, getting to Mirek seems like a highly complex puzzle that I cannot solve. "I don't know where you are," I repeat, my voice rising. "It's a loop. Just drive down the road," he says, and he hangs up. I stay in place, seething. I look for his number to call him back. It takes even longer to find it this time.
"Where are you?"
I ask, on the verge of crying. "I told you," he says. "Just get in the car and pick me up."
"No, no, you come back. I'm tired."
"It will be much faster if you drive here," he says, beginning to get angry himself. By now, Cheyenne has finished her run and arrived at the parking lot. She listens with a quizzical expression as I argue with Mirek. When I tell her why I'm so upset,
"I don't know where he is,"
I whine. She offers to go pick him up in her car.
"No," I snap. "Leave him there with those stupid chanterelles."
"Why don't we take a little walk?" she offers gently. "Just until Vitek arrives." But I do not want to walk with her. I am furious. I decide to go find Mirek myself. I get into the car and start the engine. But should I turn left or right? What did Mirek mean by a loop? I can't picture it in my mind. Finally, I pick a direction randomly and head down the road. I'm bewildered and increasingly irritated. The trees, the fields, all of them look familiar, yet at the same time unrecognizable. And no matter how hard I try to retrieve the concept of a loop from the depths of my brain, it eludes me. I drive very slowly, growing angrier and more exasperated. I begin to fixate on Mirek's behavior. I'm tired. I need to eat now, and he wants me to find him. He might as well be lost in a giant forest in a foreign country. This is Mirek's fault, entirely his fault. He gave me the wrong directions. Up ahead, I see Kasia and Vitek running along the road in my direction after finishing the cycling portion of their workout. Unlike every other time in my life, the sight of my beloved children does not make me happy. I stop, and Kasia gets into the car. Vitek keeps running to meet up with Cheyenne at the parking lot. Seeing my scowl, Kasia asks, "Mom, why are you so angry?"
"Mirek is taking so long. I want to go home. Pipshana kurki. Damn mushrooms."
"Mirek's picking mushrooms," she says soothingly. "We'll be there soon."
She gives me very simple directions. Just keep going straight, Mom. But I'm angry with her, too.
How can you be so sure that I need to go straight? I say. It's annoying. Why am I at fault for this stupid loop and the park and everything?
Her eyes well with tears. We're all here for you, she says.
Why are you so angry? She asks again.
Because he's late!
I half scream. But then, ahead of us, there is Mirek, standing at the side of the road, smiling and waving, his bike against a tree, a full bag of mushrooms in his hand. He puts his bike on the car and climbs in with his bounty. At first, he doesn't notice my dark mood.
Look at all of these, he says happily.
I refuse to look. I want to toss the chanterelles out the window.
I need to eat,
I shout. Mirek looks at me with a shocked expression. Kasia offers to drive, and I move into the passenger seat, too tired to argue with her. I sit in stony silence as we head to our picnic spot, where Vitek and Cheyenne join us. As they lay out the tablecloth and unpack sandwiches, fruit and granola bars, I fume. We eat quickly, with little conversation, my inexplicable anger unnerving them. The food helps a little, but I'm still incredibly tired and angry at the entire world. When we get home, Vitek washes the chanterelles, and I go upstairs for a nap. An hour later, I wake up and head to the kitchen to begin making dinner. Each day, cooking has become harder for me. But now, as I stand here, I can't remember what to do. Not even the simplest steps.
Where are the pots? Where are the spoons? I grumble. Why can't I find anything?
Everything is gone. My family has gone behind my back and rearranged my kitchen. I slam drawers and pull open cabinets in a frenzy.
It's all wrong. Everything has changed. Why would they do this to me?
I finally find what I need. But as I set to work, the simple recipe that I've made hundreds of times seems like a complex mathematical equation. I try to recall the ingredients and locate them in the pantry, but it's so hard. I grow more agitated, swearing and banging cabinet doors. Mirek peeks in and offers to help.
No, I shout. I make the dinner. I always make the dinner. I'm not going to stop now just because you've moved everything around.
I manage to create some strange concoction that they politely eat at a tense dinner table where no one talks. For the rest of the evening, I barely speak, and when I do, it is only to criticize them. Despite the fact that I am clearly struggling with so many simple tasks, I continue to be very driven, especially with regard to getting back to the sports I love. I have a powerful desire not to interrupt my training routine and daily life. Altering my habits means I have to accept that I am not okay. Conversely, willing myself through a draining workout proves that I can overcome any obstacle and beat any foe, even brain cancer. But my feelings of power and strength are an illusion, born, in large part, of the high doses of steroids I am taking, combined with my natural determination to survive. And while I'm feeling better, my frontal cortex is not functioning normally. Just days earlier, it was being squeezed and pressed against the inside of my skull because of the inflammation and swelling in my brain. If I hadn't been treated with high doses of steroids in the ER, I might have suffered permanent damage to my frontal lobe. I could have lost forever critical cognitive functions, such as judgment, as well as my social skills, empathy, and personality. In fact, if the inflammation and swelling had not been caught in time, had my brainstem been choked off and sent me into cardiopulmonary arrest, I could have died. Since my frontal lobe function is still compromised, my brain cannot respond appropriately when faced with complicated or demanding tasks. That morning, before we went to the park, when I was still at home in a quiet, familiar environment,
I behaved normally. For that reason, there was a strong emotional incentive for all of us to believe I really was fine, especially when I insisted I would have no problem walking in the woods.